This past summer, I traveled to Israel with a group of Boston area Christian ministers on a trip sponsored by the Boston JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council. I had done the same thing about 6 years ago. Some of you may recall my speaking about that trip or meeting some of the ministers with whom I became friends. That trip was a very uplifting experience for me. And so it was no surprise that I was looking forward to the trip this summer. What could be more fulfilling than helping to guide such a group to Israel? For Christian clergy are religious leaders whose faith connects them deeply to events that took place in the land of Israel. And they address hundreds of parishioners each and every Sunday. Think of the impact a trip like this can have on our non-Jewish friends and neighbors, particularly given the bad publicity that Israel so often receives in the press. Trips like these pose a great opportunity to present a balanced picture. A JCRC-sponsored Christian clergy trip exposes participants to the deep Jewish connections to the land, to the tremendous social and cultural accomplishments of the state, and to the complexity that is modern Israel today. Our trip started off beautifully. We visited the conservative synagogue in Haifa, where we met with an imam who, at great risk to his own personal safety, is a staunch proponent of dialogue and coexistence. We met the director of a Jewish Arab cultural center in Haifa. We visited a hospital in Nahariya, which has been quietly treating wounded Syrians for months. We went to Yamin Ord, which is a wonderful youth village in the north, and spoke with an inspiring Ethiopian woman about the marvelous work being done there to help kids coming from dysfunctional families. We traveled to Nazareth and toward the Hill of the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes is the name of that beautiful passage in the New Testament in which the Sermon on the Mount appears with familiar words like these: "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." One of our ministers explicated that passage for us. He translated that word blessed as fully satisfied. That, he said, is how he tries to feel each and every day, appreciative of all of God's blessings. That's how I was feeling that day, fully satisfied. There I was with good people, men and women of faith with whom I was getting to know in a land that I love. But then we traveled to the Church of the Loaves and the Fishes near the Sea of Galilee. I can give you the reference from the New Testament afterwards. There's been a church on that site for over 1,500 years. I'd been looking forward to going to that church. It's a beautiful church. But that day, it looked awful. The reason is that several weeks previously, it had been partially destroyed by a fire that was set by Jewish arsonists. Not only did it look awful, it smelled awful. It reeked of charred timbers. One of the African-American ministers on our trip, for whom the idea of firebombing a church is all too familiar, put it this way. The smell, he said, was the smell of hate. We walked by photographs taken on the night of the fire. Most showed the flames shooting into the sky. But there was one large picture of graffiti in Hebrew that had been sprayed on the walls of the church. It was in clear, cursive Hebrew script. V'ha'elilim karot yikaretun. And false gods shall be utterly destroyed. Does that phrase sound familiar? It should. It comes from the Aleinu, a prayer we recite at the end of virtually every service. It's in the second paragraph, not the paragraph that we recite out loud, so it might not be as familiar to many of us. It happens to be familiar to me because in the shul I attended when I was growing up, it was the practice to recite those words out loud. We therefore hope in thee, O Lord our God, that we may soon see the triumph of your might, when idolatry shall be uprooted from the earth and false gods shall be utterly destroyed. Seeing that graffiti was very upsetting to me. It was, of course, upsetting to see the damage done to the church. But what was most upsetting was realizing that those responsible were Jews, religious Jews, who committed the crime inspired by the words of the Alenu, or at least justifying their crime with the words of the Alenu. I grew up saying the Alenu. Most of us did. Has anyone ever suggested to any of us that we should take those words as a mandate to go ahead and set fire to a church? We certainly don't teach that here. That's not our Judaism. When I saw that passage from the Alenu written on the wall, I felt as though something precious had been taken away from me, from all of us. Someone took the Alenu and used it to justify an attack on a peaceful church. But do I have the right to be upset? After all, the words were quoted accurately. That's what the prayer says, doesn't it? Do I have the right to be angry that some people took those words as a mandate to do exactly what the prayer says? To try to utterly destroy what they understand to be an idolatrous house of worship? But if so, what does it mean for me or for any of us to say the Alenu? Does it mean that somehow we are complicit in crimes like this? What are we saying when we say the Alenu? Is this really the religion that we believe in? That was Thursday morning. By Thursday afternoon, we had arrived in Jerusalem. As we prepared to check into our hotel, we realized that the annual Pride Parade in Jerusalem was about to begin right around the corner. Our clergy group had about an hour before our next commitment, so our guide gave us a choice. We could either go up to our rooms and crash for an hour, or we could walk with him to where the Pride Parade was going to begin and walk with the parade for about 15 minutes back to our hotel. So about half of our group decided to check out the parade. The atmosphere couldn't have been more relaxed. The air was festive, and joyful rainbow colors abounded. We met some young people who worked at the American Consulate in Jerusalem, wearing colorful Pride t-shirts that had been produced by the American Consulate. We bought some paraphernalia, like this flag. For those in the back, that's a Jewish star in the middle with a rainbow background. As the parade was beginning, I did notice a small group of protesters just on the other side of the square. They held up signs protesting what they called the Mitzad HaToiva, the abomination parade. But the police were keeping the demonstrators far away from the marchers, so everyone was relaxed. And we slowly made our way down the block toward our hotel. And then, all of a sudden, it was as though a force field opened up in front of us. It's hard for me to describe in words. There was a hush, and the air took on a different feel. Voices ceased. I heard some popping noises and some shouts. Chovesh, chovesh, medic, medic. I saw a man with his cheek pressed against the pavement. I was confused. Was he a perpetrator or a victim? The man was dressed in black, in the uniform of the ultra-Orthodox. I didn't process the fact that he was the only one I saw dressed that way. Our guide asked me to get everyone back to the hotel and wait there. And so I ushered my colleagues to the sidewalk and down the half block to our hotel. And from there we watched as the ambulances came and went. 6 marchers were stabbed that day. One was a 16-year-old honor student at the high school adjoining the Hebrew University in Jerusalem named Shira Bunky, who later died of her wounds. And that ultra-Orthodox man whom I saw on the ground was, in fact, her murderer. Imagine the scene, if you will. There I was with a group of Christian clergy, men and women of faith. All of us had been exposed to religion at its worst for the second time that day. Religion used to hurt people rather than support people, to divide people rather than unite them, to justify desecration and violence rather than to condemn them. What we witnessed is part of a broader phenomenon. So much intolerance, hatred, and violence is now associated with religion. Most obviously, of course, in the horrifying killing fields of Iraq and Syria, but really all over the world, even in our country. And religion itself is often seen as the problem. Shortly before his death, Oliver Sacks wrote a beautiful memoir in the Sunday New York Times magazine. His mother was an observant Jew, and when she found out that he was gay, she said to him, "You are an abomination. I wish you'd never been born." Fairly or not, Oliver Sacks's reaction was to hate not his mother, but religion, which he blamed for its capacity to inspire bigotry and cruelty. Too often these days, religion is seen as a force for evil, and for good reason. Religion is increasingly being hijacked by fundamentalists who are as sure that everybody else is wrong as they are that they are right, and by religious extremists who have no hesitation acting on such beliefs to punish unbelievers. The combination is lethal. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks recently wrote a book entitled Not in God's Name, in which he grapples with religious extremism. People who care about religion, he says, have a duty to clarify the distinction between good religion and bad religion. And that's within each of our faith traditions. If all we do is to wring our hands, we are allowing indecent, intolerant, and sometimes even hateful people to hijack our faith. We essentially become enablers of their pathology and their criminality, reinforcing their incorrect and dangerous ideas about religion. A few months ago, I posted a piece in which I pointed out that in several ultra-Orthodox publications, the official portrait of the new Israeli government was doctored so that the female faces were blurred or in some cases even eliminated. One person wrote back to me, not a member of our congregation, responded angrily. "Some of my best friends," she wrote, "are ultra-Orthodox Jews." I wrote back and said, "Well, some of my best friends are ultra-Orthodox Jews too, but that shouldn't make a difference, should it? Should we be ignoring the dangers that we see before our eyes? Should we be saying as long as someone is a nice person, as long as he or she is a pious Jew, it doesn't matter that he or she holds intolerant or misogynist or even racist views? So long, say, as the object of prejudice is not me or my community or my gender or people of my sexual orientation, I can simply ignore those views? Why should that be okay?" Some of us are frankly too nostalgic and sentimental and willing to look the other way when we are approached by people whom we think of as authentic or real Jews. That man who stabbed 6 people in front of me at the Pride Parade in Jerusalem had a very long beard and very long payas. Does that make him any less of a criminal? Does that make his religiously motivated hatred of gay people any less loathsome? In a recent book entitled Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the scholar and writer James Carroll lays out the differences between good religion and bad religion. First, good religion celebrates life, not death. Let me remind all of us of the climax of today's Torah reading. God tells Abraham to sacrifice his son, and Abraham does everything he's supposed to do to accomplish that. But the story ends not with death, but with life. Vayelhu yachdav, they walked off together, Abraham and his son Isaac and the servants. They walked down that mountain together. That is what we celebrate, life and not death. Second, good religion recognizes a fundamental unity among all God's creatures. As James Carroll points out, every good religion defines compassionate love for your neighbor as the surest sign of God's presence on earth. But good religion goes further than that. Good religion is pluralistic. It acknowledges and respects the differences among us. As Rabbi Sacks puts it, our common humanity precedes our religious differences. Third, beware of holy wars and the religious leaders who promote them. Good religion does not inspire or justify violence in this world by seeing it as a precursor to an apocalypse at the end of time. Fourth, good religion knows nothing of coercion. Conscience cannot be forced. Not even God, James Carroll writes, forces the human conscience. And if God does not coerce, how blasphemous that any person or any group should be coerced in God's name. Finally, and maybe most surprising, good religion may have a secular character. Good religion doesn't have to be theistic. It can look a lot like secular humanism. Now, this is a different way of relating to our own religion and that of others than many of us were raised on. There is no place in good religion for triumphalism, for saying that we are better than they are. Every religion, ours included, includes elements of good religion and bad religion. You know who gets it? The Pope. A few months ago, Pope Francis, who later this week, by the way, will be visiting the United States for the first time in his life. And by the way, he will be in Washington, D.C. on Yom Kippur. I was speaking with a rabbi who's very worried about traffic that day. The Pope recently issued a powerful encyclical focused on the environment. He called on all men and women, not just all Christians, all men and women, to join together with him to do nothing less than save the planet. And guess what? A few weeks later, several Muslim leaders came out with a statement of their own, also urging us to unite to preserve and protect the environment. And Jewish leaders have done the same, including Dr. Arnold Eisen, the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, who endorsed the Pope's message in his High Holiday letter. The Pope and all of those religious leaders share a vision of people of faith, whatever that faith happens to be, or in the case of secularists, not be, respecting one another and working with one another to address the needs of humanity. Let's respond to the Pope's call. Let's join with other adherents of good religion, whatever their faiths happen to be, and with secular men and women as well, to try to arrest the destruction of our planet and to fight poverty and to fight injustice and the other social ills as well. That is good for the world, an ultimate concern of good religion. But what are we going to do about the Alenu? Do we dump it? Do we embrace it? What do we do? The clue is already present in the words of Jonathan Sacks and James Carroll. We have to be smart about religion, just like we have to be smart about just about every other choice we make in life. Our religion is, what, 4,000 years old? Over the years, it's accumulated a variety of thoughts and opinions and attitudes. Some are elevating, others are odious. There is no one and only one interpretation of what Judaism says about anything. To pretend that there are no aspects of our tradition that we find offensive is unrealistic. In the same way, some of the insights and advice that we got from our parents, that we got from our grandparents, some of them we continue to live by, and some of those ideas we've walked away from a long time ago. When we look to our past, we have to make good, smart choices. The short answer is this: if we understand the Alenu to be mandating the burning of churches, then we should not be reciting it. No one should. But there is another approach we can take. As Jonathan Sacks rightly points out, the sacred literatures of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all contain passages that, read literally, are capable of leading to violence and hate, and we may and must reinterpret them. When we say the words "V'ha'elilim karot yikaretun," which incidentally allude to a passage in Isaiah written well over 2,500 years ago, we read them in context. They point to the very next phrase in the Alenu, which calls for perfecting the world in the image of God's kingdom. That's the tikkun olam that we're always talking about. But in fact, there are indeed idolatries that, I'll speak for myself, I would love to see disappear, and I'll bet all of us would like to see disappear. Terror, after all, is the epitome of idolatry. And what about the idolatries that bring about and sustain poverty and misery and injustice and violence in places like Syria or North Korea, along the Russian-Ukrainian border, throughout parts of Africa or Asia, and unfortunately in many, many places around the world? Yes, it would be great if everyone appreciated the right of human beings to live in free, just, and humane societies. We're not there yet, though. And we can't wait for those idolatries that are preventing the world from truly being in the image of God's kingdom to disappear. That's how we can and should read the Alenu, not as some kind of holy justification for committing a crime. Right after the stabbings at the Pride Parade, my fellow ministers and I stood in front of our hotel, watching as the medics tended to the wounded and the ambulances evacuated them. And as is so characteristic of Israel, and as you might already have imagined, the parade continued in a quiet, subdued, yet determined way. My Christian colleagues and I sat around and talked about religious extremism, about people willing to take the name of the Lord in vain, about seeing such vivid evidence of religiously inspired evil. As you can imagine, we were all sad. We were all upset. But at the same time, I felt so fortunate, so appreciative to be with and to talk about what had happened and what it all meant with that wonderful group of thoughtful religious leaders with whom I was traveling. Sharing the aftermath of what we had witnessed reinforced my own appreciation of the importance of religion, good religion, our religion, playing a positive, constructive role in our lives and in our world. Our conversations reminded me of a beautiful verse from the book of Malachi, which we read as part of the Haftarah on Shabbat HaGadol, the Shabbat right before Pesach, when we think about the future, the Messianic era. Az nidbru yir'e Adonai ish et reyehu, vayakshev Adonai, vayishama vayichatev sefer zicharon, lefanav li'yir'e Adonai ulechoshvei shemo. Then those who revere God, who love God, talked with one another, and God paid heed and listened. And concerning all of these, it was written into a book of remembrance. The image in that verse is of men and women of faith, perhaps different faiths, not killing one another, but talking with one another and listening to one another, face to face, heart to heart. And what happens next? And God paid heed. This, according to that verse, is what God listens to, human dialogue. And this is followed by it being remembered and recalled in a book of remembrance. You want to know how do we get into the book of remembrance, the book of life? By talking humbly and respectfully with one another. By listening to one another. That's what God listens to. That's what deserves to be remembered in the book of remembrance, the book of life, on Rosh Hashanah and every day. Az nidberu yir'e Adonai. Then those who love God talked with one another. The Hebrew is an unusual verbal form. Instead of the more common dibru, it's nidberu. Instead of they spoke to one another, they were spoken to by one another. In other words, they spoke and they were spoken to. They conversed. They listened. That is what my minister friends and I did on this trip, and that's what we hope to continue to do. And that's what I hope that all of us will do. Talk amongst ourselves and with other men and women who share a commitment to good religion, whatever its name, about the positive role that faith can play in addressing the many, many problems in this world in which we live. There is no shortage of problems. There is plenty to talk about. As Malachi implies, let's not just talk, but also, through our commitment to our form of Judaism, let's promote peace and justice. Let's bring food, clothing, and shelter, and good health and joy throughout the world. And then, in the words of both the Aleinu and also the Beatitudes, that inspiring address uttered on that hill overlooking the Sea of Galilee, may we be worthy of inheriting the Malchut Shaddai, the kingdom of heaven. Shana Tovah.